Hello and welcome to episode 33 of Two Chairs Talking, a podcast run by myself, David Grigg, and my co-host, as always, Perry Middlemiss. How's things, Perry?
Good, thanks, David. Although things have changed just a tad in Melbourne since we last spoke.
Yes, we're now in a state of disaster, not merely a state of emergency, but a state of disaster.
Well, the weirdest thing was hearing that strange word curfew, which
yes.
I don't believe we've ever had applied to us previously in this state. And now we have a curfew from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. for 6 weeks.
Yep. So you've got to stay at home unless you've got an absolute rock-solid reason to be out, and that's the rock-solid reason's got to be to go to work, I think, after the curfew. You can't even go shopping or seek medical attention or any of those things, and it's really
You
probably seek medical attention, I suppose.
If you had a medical emergency after 8 p.m.
Yeah, sure.
You can call an ambulance. You can't hold on. That's all right. You're not supposed to be going out of the house to go buying any food or shopping or going for any exercise or anything. But I went out this morning to go for a walk, and the streets are pretty deserted. Very deserted.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway. And everyone wearing a mask.
Everybody's wearing a mask, which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing.
Yep.
It is a good thing.
Anyway, we've just been sitting at home, haven't we, David?
We're sitting in our little bubbles here. It's just like being on a spacecraft somewhere, isn't it, really?
It is a bit.
Just on our way to Jupiter or something.
As long as you're not going to Uranus like they did in Ad Astra, because that'd be incredibly boring, like the film. But there we go. We mentioned that last week. And as we said last week, this week we're moving on to something else.
Indeed. Now, I believe, Perry, that you've been attending the World Science Fiction Convention over the weekend.
Can you tell us
about that?
I have been attempting to attend bits and pieces of it as a virtual Worldcon, the first one of its type. It's been very strange, really, to be involved in a virtual convention where all of your meetings are done via Zoom or Discord, which I found rather weird. And I spoke to my son about this, and I told him about that a lot of the interactions were being done by Discord. And he was of the view that that was a very strange thing to be using because it was mostly a gaming platform. But anyway, Zoom was... it worked pretty well, and thank God that we have that available, because otherwise we would have been struggling. But it worked out all right. Generally, they weren't too bad. You do find, though, that with Zoom meetings, it's quite strange that you can actually find out that somebody is able to talk for 10 minutes without drawing breath. I never knew that that was able to be done. I did know that the Indigenous Australians, with their didgeridoos, have a tendency to sort of circular breathe. They sort of breathe in and out in one flow. And I think some of these Zoom participants have finally got around to learning this ancient and arcane and really magical technique, because they just don't shut up.
They just keep on going.
And you need to be able to put your hand up and say, oh, excuse me, can I say something? Because otherwise,
particularly when there's a lot of people, it can be really hard to sort of break in and into a conversation, I think.
Absolutely. But anyway.
The more people, the worse. Yeah.
Look, they did the best they could in the circumstances, and I think they did a pretty good job. We all have a bit of a chat in a minute about some of the things that came out about it, but no, it was all right.
Sure. I mean, it was a tragedy for them that they couldn't hold the actual physical convention like they'd been planning for 10 years. But still, they rolled with the punches, and they seem to have done pretty well.
I can't even imagine the emotional toil that would have taken.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine there were tears, that's for sure.
The toll would have been terrible. It would just, you've done all that hard slog thinking, right, everybody's going to turn up, we're going to have a good big party, and everybody's going to enjoy it, and then they're going to go off and go around New Zealand, and New Zealand fandom will just explode because of this. Flat.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very sad. Anyway. Yeah. There we go.
But the one thing we probably should talk about in a bit more detail was the fact that they had the Hugo Award ceremony.
Yep.
Again, virtual. And George R.R. Martin was the toastmaster, who some people seem to think went on a bit long and about things that he shouldn't have. But never mind, we won't touch that, I don't think.
Well, we could. We could.
We could.
I'll mention some of the controversies that came out about it all. But look, it was a long ceremony. It really was. Over 3 hours.
That's too long.
You know, there's 19 awards they give out.
Gosh.
19. There's basically two associated awards they give out. That's the Astounding Award for Best New Writer. That used to be called the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, but that was changed after last year's contretemps in Dublin. Yes. And the Lodestar Award, which is the Young Adult Award, which was brought in a few years ago. So they are the two that are added in. And there are 17 categories for the Hugo's Awards now. And people keep talking about wanting to add others.
Yeah. Come on, no, please. Crazy.
No. So I think what we should do, David, is just basically talk about the fiction awards quickly.
Sure.
And then
sure.
mention some of the dramatic presentation ones, if you like, and then move on. So how about we start at the top at the big one, as George calls it, the novel. That was won by A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martin. Pick that one. Really
yes,
happy.
Good. Well
it's
done.
Good, it's a good book. I can recommend you read that one. I think if you haven't read it, I reckon you'll enjoy it.
Oh, well, I've got it there on the Hugo voting package, but I haven't actually got to it yet.
Well, there you are. I think it's a very good one. It's going to be the start of a series, so best that you get in on the ground floor and catch up now before you have to follow up with a lot of reading later on. Novella was won by This Is How You Lose the Time War, M.L.L. Motar and Max Gladstone. Second one I got right, David.
You picked that, yes.
Two out of two. I thought that was good. Again, as I said, and we said a while back, it's very similar to the novella that was written a couple of years ago by, was it Ian McDonald, Time Was, but I didn't think it was as good as that. But anyway, look, it was the best of the ones that are there, and that's all you can do. You can only be the best of the ones that are nominated and are there. Oh, one thing that has come out from the Hugo Awards, which I should mention in the novel, that after the Hugo Awards are announced, the Hugo administrators give out all the statistics for all of the books that were nominated, well, the top 10 or 12 or so nominated, and the voting statistics, how they basically, where they started in terms of their first votes and all the way right down through and how they were knocked out in the way through. Interesting to note that Anne Leckie's, and as you remember, she did the Ancillary series a few years ago, which were excellent. She wrote or published last year in 2019 a book called The Raven Tower, which is her first fantasy novel, which I haven't read. It received enough nominations to make the final ballot, but she declined the nomination.
Ah, how come?
I don't know. They don't ever say. All they say is that she received enough nominations, about third, I think, in terms of the nominations, but knocked it back. Why she did that, don't know. Her choice. She'll do what she wants. But anyway, that was just interesting.
Just before you go on from that, in reading some of the responses that people had to their awards, I was interested to see that Neil Gaiman was talking about the fact that Terry Pratchett had a book nominated for the Hugo Best Novel some years ago, but he withdrew it for reasons I'm not totally clear of.
I think Gaiman basically said that Pratchett felt that being nominated and having to wait for the Hugo Awards ceremony, which is about second last night or the last night of the convention, would totally ruin his convention.
Yeah, that's what he said. That's
his anxiety levels would be so high that he wouldn't be able to handle it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. No, okay. Fair enough.
Well, if you go with the idea that you're not going to win, if you do win, hey, it's an added bonus. But maybe maybe he couldn't come to that. So anyway, you know, I've been in situations where I've been nominated for awards and I thought, nah, I'm not going to win this, and have it on one occasion. On another occasion, I did win it. Odd, but there we go. All right, so Novelette was run by Emergency Skin by N.K. Jemison. I had this as number 4 on my list, so didn't do very well with that one.
No, me neither. I didn't rate it very highly.
Short story winner was As the Last I May Know by S. L. Huang. Again, I had that as number 4 on my list. So, again, didn't do very well. So I ended up with 2 out of the 4. So that's a bad average for me. I think that probably did as best as I'm going to be able to do. So, anyway, it's not so bad.
But the two biggies, you got the two biggies.
Got the two biggies. Now,
works.
A couple of other notes. The related work. This is a piece
Yes.
of. It cannot be fiction in any form, shape, or form. It can be anything else. Now, I always thought the anything else was probably going to be a published work, but the 2019 John W. Campbell Award acceptance speech by Jeanette Ng was nominated, and it won.
Yeah, that's
There's
amazing.
a bit of controversy about that one on the basis that, from my perspective, it's a 3-minute off-the-cuff speech as opposed to all these books that were written that take years of research. So
Yeah, it doesn't seem right to me, but
your
what the
mileage
heck?
may vary, but I wouldn't have had it there.
It struck me as being pretty odd.
Yeah, okay. So another couple that we deal with is dramatic presentation. So the dramatic presentation long form, the winner was Good Omens, the whole
Yes.
series. That was the Pratchett and Gaiman series, television series you were just talking about.
Yep.
Short form, the winner was The Good Place with The Answer, the episode of The Answer.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
No, I haven't seen it either, so.
I've watched the two episodes of of Watchmen that were nominated, which were both excellent, but I say this is the good place I haven't seen, so don't know.
I think I've got a feeling that the Watchmen. Well, I can tell you because I've actually got the. Just let me check for a minute. Long for. Okay, The Good Place was first. Second in a tie was one episode of The Watchmen, a God Walks Into a Bar, and The Mandalorian Redemption. That was the
Oh, okay.
best of the episodes of that particular series that we discussed last week, I think. So that's where they ended up. Now, a personal favourite of ours, The Expanse, Sybolla Byrne came in at number four, but the written series of The Expanse won the Best Series Award. So that's good. That's a good award given to probably the best of the, well, hard science fiction series going around at the moment. And as I mentioned on a Facebook post, my father would have been very happy about that because he was a big fan and was reading the series only up to within about a week of his death. So he really, really enjoyed it, and I'm very pleased with that. So that's good.
And I think that episode of The Expanse was okay, but it wasn't it didn't seem to me to be the best that they've done. So I think it's probably fair that it didn't win that particular category.
Oh, yeah, but I like the stuff so much, David. I don't really care. I'd rather it won. But there we go. That's different strokes.
I think I told you by email that I was just watching the Hugo ceremony intermittently and kept coming in and out. And in fact, for a while, I was sitting at my computer doing other stuff, and I had it run the video running in a little picture-in-picture window in the corner of my screen. But because of that, I had the closed captions turned on. And so I was kind of
Oh, yeah.
reading the what they were saying, and of course it was one of those things where it's electronically translated in real time. And so the most amusing point for the night for me was when the next category was announced, which was going to be the best rheumatic presentation.
Yeah, there were a few things. I know that Charlie Jane Anders is she and Emily Newitt's won the best fan cast, and Charlie Jane Anders' name was translated into Chocolate Jackhammer, which I think is just stunningly funny,
Well, that
and
should be her alias from now
it
on.
should be her alias from now on. And basically, what it comes to is. Final thing before we finish on the 2020s, which I want to talk about in terms of the novels. Interestingly enough, and I'm just putting this up as a comment because I think this is indicative of how the SF field is changing over the last 10 or so years. The last five best novel awards have been won by women. This year, every nominee on the ballot was written by a person who identifies as female. And so the last five or seven, six of the last seven novel Hugos have been won by women.
Wow. Yeah, there you
There's a
go.
big change because it comes up when we start talking about the 1963 awards there. We've got a there's something I want to mention there which relates to this.
Okay,
So we might as well
sure.
just move on to the 1963 Hugo time machine if you'd
Indeed,
like to
so we'll
tag
do
on.
that. We're going to go back to the year 1963. The Hugo Time Machine. Yeah, so 1963, which was an interesting year for science fiction. The nominees for particularly the novel category again was pretty interesting. So where do we start, Perry?
The Hugo Awards were given at Discon 1 in Washington, D.C. And that's sort of interesting because Discon 3 in Washington, D.C. is the Worldcon to be held in 2021. Yep. So that's a good thing to be thinking about. But I think we might as well just start into the novels and just work our way through that. Again, we have this particular year, we only have two categories. That is the novel and the short fiction.
Yep.
They still hadn't got to the point where they were splitting the short fiction out into the various category lengths.
Yeah. Which is pretty silly when you think about it. One of the nominees is a 4-page short story, and another nominee is like a full length novella, pretty long novella.
Well, quite a long novella.
So how are you trying to compare those two? It's pretty hard, I think.
Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Anyway, so the first one, I'll deal with the first one. The first one is The Sword of Alderness. I think it's The Sword of Alderness by Marion Zimmer Bradley. This was an ace double. This is number 2 in her Darkover series. It was originally published with The Planet Savers, which was number 1 in the series. Well, that's chronologically written, by the way, not what the final timeline is going to be. There was, I don't know, 20-odd novels in this whole series overall, but she wrote them all out of sequence. And so I thought that I'd read Planet Savers first and then go on to read The Sword of Alderness because I was thinking, you probably have to read the first one before you get the second one. Well, in fact, you don't. Now, the reason why Zimmer Bradley is interesting on this particular ballot, and I went back and did a check this morning just to make sure I was right on this, she's the first woman who has appeared on the Hugo novel ballot. She doesn't win, but she's the first one that has appeared there. So that's interesting. Now, before I go into the discussion of this particular novel, there's a couple of subgenres of science fiction that I want to give an explanation for. Because this particular book or this particular series has been noted as being one of the prime examples of one of these genres. So the higher level genre that I want to talk about is a planetary romance. Now, these deal with SF stories where the bulk of the action takes place on one or more exotic planets. So that is non-Earth planets, somewhere else in the galaxy. Now, these planets are often inhabited by very human-like aliens, you know, sort of think Star Trek all the time, where everybody came across was a variant on a human, a bipedal, two arms, two legs, one head, just different facial structures.
Makes it easier to do the costuming, I think.
It does. But in these planetary romances, a lot of time, interbreeding between humans and these other aliens is sometimes possible. And as you and I would know, David, that's like you and I trying to basically interbreed with carrot. It just isn't going to work. So generally, the planets are hospitable to human life. So humans just get out of the spaceship and just wander around. It's like going outside into your backyard, which is all we're allowed to do at the moment, but you know what I mean. It's basically exactly the same as that. Now, that's the higher level genre, and underneath that, there is a form of another subgenre which has been referred to as sword and planet. And this is a bit like sword and sandal stuff. You remember the sword and sandal gladiator stuff where everybody just uses swords and they're basically all dealing with sandals. So it's, you know, like the Russell Crowe film, The Gladiator, would fit into the sword and sandal style Spartacus as well. But this being sword and planet, it's a planetary romance where the adventures involve hand-to-hand combat of some form, but they only ever use swords and knives. They don't use energy weapons or guns or any of that form. Even though they've got a very high level of weaponry and technology on these planets, it's basically the idea that you have to get up and close, up close and personal.
What does that remind me of? Lightsabers, is that right?
Possibly, but that's a bit high tech. Here we're actually, lightsabers is sort of like that, but it's a high tech version of a sword. But here we're actually talking about actual metal swords or daggers, right?
Yeah. So we're thinking things like Princess of Mars and John Carter of Mars.
So the Edgar Rice Burroughs, I always want to say Edgar Rice Bubbles. Edgar
Me
Rice
too,
Burroughs
yeah. Yeah.
stuff and the Marion Zimmer Bradley Darkover novels are considered to be prime examples of this particular genre.
Okay.
Now, this particular book is the Darkover series, is set in a galaxy which is slowly being taken over by Earth, Terrans. So they're taking it over in terms of politics and business. They're not basically undertaking a invasion of the planets. They're just basically turning up and just letting business and politics just take over. Now, so the planet of Darkover is a holdout, however, on the edge of the galaxy. It's trying to retain its cultural identity in the face of the technology onslaught coming in from Earth. Lou Alton, who's half Terran and half Darkovian, so here we go with this idea that, that male he's got a Darkover father and an Earth woman mother. They've been able to interbreed. He's there. He's been away from Earth. He's been away from Darkover for a fair while. And he returns to Darkover after about 6 years and plunges directly into some political and power struggle. Straight off the bat, he doesn't even know what's going on. He starts telling everybody what to do, which I thought was pretty weird. Now, you don't need to have read the first one to be able to get to the first of the Darkover books to be able to get to this one, as I said. And the problem with the book is, this particular book is there's too many characters just flitting across the stage in short form. They're there for a page and gone. And then later on, you have to remember who they are and what they did and what connection they had to the main character. And it just basically, it just gets really, really confusing. It's all over the place. Now, there are the other point that I found difficult with this is that there are three female characters with first names very similar to each other that all start with MAR or MARJ. And I just got confused because, again, the first time they come on, somebody just walks on, just walks off the other side, says something, and just goes. Somebody else, a couple of pages later, come in and think, hang on, is that the same one that was there before? And then one of them gets referred to by name and then gets referred to by a nickname that's
Oh,
also
no.
very similar. And I got confused. And again, you remember said a while back, asked you, did you think it was necessary for a reader to carry out a lookup, make up a lookup character list to be able to work out who everybody was? I needed to do it with this.
Yeah.
And again, there's the problem of all of the male characters are called by their family name, or the female characters are called by their first name. This was a very popular and common writing technique back in the 50s and 60s, but it's bloody awful. I really don't like it very much at all. And it's demeaning to everybody. What I came out with is, this is a really short book of 154 pages, and it actually reads like the synopsis of a much larger novel. This could have been 400 pages. It's 154. If it had been 400 pages, although it was probably pushing it a bit, I actually would have felt more comfortable with it because I reckon I would have been able to figure out who everybody was and have a bit of an idea about what's going on. The author actually later rewrote this book and basically, changed the name and just wrote it and made it bigger. I think she suddenly realised later on that she really was cramming too much into this. I only gave this 3.0 out of 5, David. Look, if you're interested in the Darkover series, you're interested in Marion Zimmer Bradley, if you're interested in the history of the genre and you want to read the first book nominated by a woman that ended up on the ballot, then read it. Otherwise,
Give it a miss.
yeah.
All right. So I think I am going to talk next about a book called Silva, Sylva, Silva, by someone called Vercors, Vercours. Now, this is a really interesting book. One of the interesting things about this book is that it's the first book, I believe, that was nominated for the best novel at Hugo, which was in translation. It was translated from the French. The author, Vercors, is actually a pseudonym of someone called Jean-Marcel Adolphe Brûler, who was born in 1902. And he was a French writer who was during the Second World War, he joined the resistance and sort of fought against the Nazis. And while he was doing that, he was writing, and his books or writings were published under the pseudonym Vercors. And he's apparently written, he apparently wrote quite a few books which had a fantasy or science fiction theme. I could talk about some of those, but I won't go into any detail. But anyway, he, in 1960, he wrote this book, Silver. And it was translated by his wife, Rita Baris, and was a finalist for the 1963 Hugo Award. Now, the interesting thing is that the concept is bizarre. I actually read the first couple of pages of this and skipped to the last couple of pages and thought, oh, this is a lot of rubbish. It's just not worth looking at. But I actually got hooked and I read the whole book and actually turned out to, ended up enjoying it quite a bit. So the premise, which is kind of admittedly absurd, is this guy who's an English, he owns a manor or part of a manor, and he is called Albert Richwick, and he owns this place called Richwick Manor. And he's always been dead against the sport of fox hunting. Anyway, one night he's out and he hears the hunt coming towards him. They're chasing a fox, and he goes into his house, and he looks out the window and he can see that the hunt is getting closer, and he sees the fox sort of try to get into his garden, and he sort of stands up to look more closely, and he frightens the fox and it doesn't come into the garden, but runs along, well, sorry, it comes into the garden, runs along the edge of a hedge, so he goes out really trying to discourage the hunt because he really doesn't want this fox to be killed. And he goes out and he sees the fox dodge into a hole in the hedge and goes closer. He's going to go try and dissuade the hunt when they get closer. But the dogs, the hounds from the hunt, get to the hole in the hedge and sort of back off. Something strange is happening. They get really freaked and run away. And he can see this some sort of creature in the hedge, and he pulls this creature out. And he's still not quite sure what it is, and the hunt is still getting closer. So he actually throws himself on this creature to stop it from getting away and getting hunted by the hounds. And then so the hunt actually goes on and goes away, and they've lost the fox. And so this guy climbs up from the creature he's thrown himself on top of, and it's a naked woman. The fox has somehow transformed itself into a woman, a human woman. So this is this kind of miracle, or this you know, totally impossible sort of scenario. But then he's left with this woman who's still got the brain and instincts of a fox. It's just acting as though it was the fox, and so he doesn't think he can let it go, and this woman let her go because goodness knows what's going to happen to her. So he brings her into the house. And to cut a fairly long story short, he actually tries to raise this fox in the form of a woman and civilize her, if you like. And that's what the whole course of the book is about. And so it's really a book about becoming human, becoming from the animal into being a human being, and the stages that you sort of have to go through. And there's really quite a transformative moment, fair way into the book, where, because he gives this young woman a name, Silver, and there's something else I'll connect that with to in a second, but he gives it a name, and there's a point at which she finally understands about death. She's slowly sort of gaining human understanding, and there's a point where she suddenly finally twigs that people die and that she will die. And that's kind of the transformative moment in which she becomes fully human. So it's actually quite a deep novel. It's well written, but quite well written. And I thought that was, it's really interesting. Now, the book apparently was inspired by an earlier book, which was written in 1922 by someone called David Garnett, called Lady into Fox. And this is the reverse of that. In David Garnett's novel, a woman gets turned into a fox. And in this book, it's the other way around. The fox gets turned into a woman, so it's really curious. So it kind of ends in a bit of a way I didn't quite like, but it's a curious book and really, really an interesting book. So I actually would rate it pretty high. So I ended up giving it 4 stars on Goodreads. I thought it was interesting. I really didn't expect it. I thought this was going to be a piece of total rubbish, and it turned out not to be.
Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah, well, that's good. No, I didn't get a chance to read this because I just couldn't find a copy of it anywhere.
Yeah,
So,
well, I only found it. I'll tell you how I found it. I finally found a copy on the Internet Archive, and because it's still essentially, I suppose, in copyright, you can borrow it from the Internet Archive for the princely time of 1 hour. So you can borrow it and read it for an hour, and then you go on. So I have to confess, I did a few screen grabs and went through and read it, but I'll dispose of those shortly.
research
But
purposes only, David.
research purposes, for review purposes only. But
Yeah.
yeah, it was a surprise. It's a real surprise to me, this book.
I don't believe it's in print. I don't believe it's
No,
available. Anyway, if you're lucky
no.
enough to find a second-hand copy, you're doing very, very well. But
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
first translated book. I don't think we get another one for quite some time.
No,
I'm
that'd be
not
right.
sure when the next one was. I know we've had one translated novel that has won it, the Chinese novel, The Three Body Problem, from a couple of years ago, but take a bit of research to go back and have a bit of a look to see whether anything else is there that, did Lem ever get, did Stanislaus Lem ever get nominated?
I don't think anything by Lem would
The
ever have got
Stragetsky
nominated. It might
Brothers?
have been nominated. The Solaris came out in English translation in 1970. It was written in
Maybe.
about 1960. Yeah, it
Okay.
was written in 1960, so it would have been kind of eligible the previous year
Okay.
if it had been translated into English, but it hadn't been.
We can look at that problem later, but it's not
Yeah,
just something
sure.
that cropped up and on. Given that we're talking about 60 years and about five or six books per year, so we're talking well over 300 novels here. I don't have them all in my head, David. Don't know
No,
about you.
indeed.
Can't keep that many there. Well, my next book that I looked at was Little Fuzzy by H.B. Piper. This
Yes,
is
yes.
a lovely little book.
Yeah, it's
It's
fun. It's a
great.
lot of
It's
fun.
a lot of fun. It's got nothing terribly. Oh no, well, actually, it does. Let me. No, I'm being a little bit harsh, but anyway, let me explain what it is. So, H.B. Piper, nice name for a science fiction writer.
Yes.
Beam. I think his first name was Harold, but having yourself as Beam, second name, pretty good. Now, this is another one of those novels where humans are spread across the galaxy and are settling and exploiting planets as they go. Now, on the planet of Zarathustra Company has the rights to exploit this class three uninhabited planet. Now, that's important, not necessarily the fact that it's class three and whatever that means, but the uninhabited part is the interesting thing. Because surveys have been done and they've been, while there are a number of indigenous life forms, there's been nothing there that's found that's of shows any form of intelligence. Well, this company is basically going in and it's just wreaking havoc all over the place, trying to rip as much money out of it as it can, causing large amounts of environmental damage all over the place, changing the weather patterns. Whoa, does that sound familiar? In terms of our current view, stripping out large forests, draining swamps, and then suddenly realizing that they're getting droughts everywhere. That does sound familiar. Anyway, the main character of this particular book, Jack Halloway, is a one-man show. He's prospecting for things called sunstones, which are sort of like opals, ancient fossilized jellyfish that have turned in that can turn into wonderful gemstones if cut properly and polished and are worth a fair amount of money. So he's basically trying to prospect for these stones. When he comes back to his camp on one day and discovers a small furry bipedal animal hiding in his bathroom or hiding in his house, and he starts playing with this thing because it seems to be fairly friendly, and he starts thinking that it starts demonstrating a bit of intelligent or sapient traits that he's not terribly sure about. And a day or so later, the whole family turns up. So all these small, they're only about a metre high, thereabouts, maybe a bit more. Well, the whole family turns up. So it's father, mother, a couple of kids, and a little baby. He refers to the first one of them as Little Fuzzy and then decides to call all of the rest of them Fuzzies as a sort of a generic name. Now, word of his discovery of these things starts getting out, and he wants to basically make sure that, well, he believes, Holloway believes, that these creatures are intelligent up to a certain degree, and that therefore the status of the planet is going to completely change. Now, as you can imagine, the major company running the planet doesn't particularly want this to come out, because if
No.
it does, then they lose their rights to being able to exploit the planet, and it suddenly becomes into a big nature reserve, because the Federation of Planets that are backing behind this society in this particular novel are always on the lookout for sapient species. They've found sort of 7, 8, or 9 of them in the galaxy so far, and they are very adamant that you have to leave them as much alone as possible and not wreck the planet. The company, of course, tries to discredit Holloway. There's a bit of a problem in terms of one of the species gets killed by one of the company's representatives. Holloway shoots somebody that was going to shoot him. And so there's this big court case where the major part of the particular court case is to define what it means to be intelligent. Now, the way the Federation has been running up until this particular time is that they say that you're intelligent if you've invented the wheel or invented or can use fire. Well, these fuzzies don't do either. They don't use fire and they haven't invented a wheel. But they are showing enough indication of intelligence that basically they win over everything, win the case. And there they are. It's the whole part of the novel. The major part of the novel, the interest part of the novel, is in the discussions about what it is to be intelligent and how do you identify that. So this is basically, in essence, a first contact novel
Yes.
where humans come into first contact with another intelligent species, which is a bit like them, but not like them. And so you get this lovely exploration of what it is to be intelligent, and that's what makes this thing basically stand out. Piper published a sequel of this called Fuzzy Sapiens in 1964, and John Scalzi wrote Fuzzy Nation in 2011,
Well, we should talk about that, yeah.
which I believe you've read, David.
I have read. There's a little bit of background, I think, to this, which is that H.B. Piper, in fact, committed suicide in 1964. And it appears that the last few years of his life were pretty depressing. And he didn't renew any of his copyrights. So Little Fuzzy, and in fact almost all of H.B. Piper's short stories and novels, are now in the public domain in America because the copyright was never renewed. And in fact, Little Fuzzy is available from standard ebooks, which I've talked about on this podcast a few times. So it's available in a really nice, nicely formatted ebook format for free from standardebooks.org. So I really wonder about John Scalzi writing this thing, this book called Fuzzy Nation, which is really just a complete rewrite of Piper's novel. And I'm wondering whether part of that was that because it was in the public domain, the publishers couldn't make any more money out of it. And so they thought that if they got Scalzi to write this thing, they could make money out of his version of the thing. Now, Scalzi's version is updated in all sorts of ways, and it probably has more depth of character than the original book does, but nevertheless, it's kind of like a blatant rip-off of the original story, and I do wonder why you would do that. It's really quite an odd thing to do, but there we are. So yes, Fuzzy Nation is a more modern, slightly more modern take, but it's basically exactly the same scenario. It's the same planet, and we have a bit more maneuvering, political maneuvering, I suppose, about the organization, the corporation that's running the place, but that's about it. So yeah, I think it's an odd situation to have had. But anyway, there you go.
Piper's novel doesn't go deeply into characterization.
No.
People are basically black or white. They're either very good or very bad. All of the company people are bad until they decide to turn. So they move from black completely over to white. And all the guys that are on the fuzzy side are all white.
Yeah.
And so it's just the way that just the hats are just decide the one colour, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a bit more depth in the Scousy version of it, but even so, I think it's an odd thing to do. Anyway, that's just me.
Yeah, well, I gave this one 3.6, so that would round it up to a 4 out of 5. And I think it's a pleasant little thing. If you want to get a bit of an indication of what those fuzzies probably look like, and it may even have had an impact on them. If you think of the Ewoks out of Star Wars, it's probably that sort of creature.
Yep. All right, so the next book we've got in the list is A Fall of Moondust by Arthur C. Clarke. So what do we say about this? It has a very interesting concept, I think you've got to say, which is that, and this is all done because before we knew very much about the moon's surface, at that stage they'd really only got telescopic views of the moon. There hadn't even been the Ranger series of probes that sort of crash landed into the moon to sort of get more closer pictures. And so it was an unknown situation, but they figured that there probably was a good deal of dust on the moon. It's been battered by meteorites and micrometeorites over the millennia. And indeed, that's true. The as we saw from the Apollo landings, there's a lot of very fine dust on the surface of the moon. So, but in those days, the knowledge was pretty poor. But so the concept is, I think, a clever one, which is that this very, very fine dust gathers into particular locations, almost as though it was a liquid. And there's this particular place on the moon where this dust has become almost like a sea, quite deep sea. This is called the Sea of Thirst, they've dubbed it. Because it acts like a liquid, you can actually run craft over it, not quite sailing craft, but things that can move over the surface on, I think, on skis or something like that. And so we look at this particular pleasure craft, which is a tourist craft called the Selene. And this guy called Pat Harris is the pilot of this, and takes people on these tours of the lunar landscape, sailing across this sea of dust. And this dust actually, in very peculiar ways, it's not at all. It's like a liquid in some ways, but not like a liquid in others. Anyway, what happens, to cut the long story short, is that there's a sort of a moonquake, and there's a sort of hole opens up in this sea of dust, and sucks down this craft with all these tourists on board, and buries it under who knows how deep an amount of dust. And so it's really a suspense novel about how do the authorities figure out that the craft is, this has happened to the craft. Where is the craft gone missing? For quite a while they think it's been buried under a landslide of rocks and things, and they'll never be able to get, you know, everybody must have been killed, and they'd never be able to recover the bodies. But slowly, as the story goes on, there's someone on a satellite, which the Lagrange point between the Earth and the Moon, who does an infrared study of the surface and comes up with this theory that the Selene has actually gone down in the midst of the Sea of Thirst, and manages to convince the people on the moon that this is the case, and they can go hunting for it with infrared, and they eventually do locate it. And then the whole rest of the story is, once they've located this craft with the people on board who are all still alive, they discover, how the heck do they get it out? And so it's quite a well handled suspense story of how they finally managed to rescue these people who are in the craft. And of course, the other part of the story is all about the people, the passengers and the pilot and so on board the craft, and how they cope with the situation that they're in. For quite a while, they don't know whether they're going to be rescued or whether even people know that they're there. So that's all reasonably well done. If you just see it as a story like that, it's pretty, not too bad. The problem really is that the characterization is pretty wooden. And there's a kind of a romance happens between the pilot of this craft, Pat Harris, and the attendant, the stewardess, Sue Wilkins, and this romance builds during the course of them being trapped underneath. But the dialogue between the two is almost ludicrous, because it's really, really very clunky. And the other thing you've got to say about it is that it's really full of, perhaps not misogyny, but certainly very sexist attitudes going back to these times. And I don't know. There's a whole bunch of things that just, I went through highlighting things, and it just became pretty obvious that the attitudes of the time of male domination and so on, like they have electronic machines that transcribe people's writing. And of course, they're all she. They're all called she because, you know, if you're a secretary, then you've got to be female, obviously. And there's one woman who's a one woman passenger who creates a bit of a problem for Pat Harris. And she's like really sort of waspy and difficult to get on with character. And so you have this phrase, you know, the stewardess Sue Wilkins says, "You know what her trouble is?" "What?" So asked Pat. "I suppose you could call it ingrowing virginity, you know, so what she needs is a good root," basically, is what she's what the end of that sort of sentence is supposed to be. But yeah, that's the thing which really drags it down to me. It's if you leave it alone as just as the suspense story, it's not bad, but the characterization and the attitudes at the time are really a bit hard to take, I think.
Yeah, I found that. I found the characters, I made a note about how they were squeezed out of a toothpaste tube, basically. They were all... And why only have one pilot? And they allow smoking on the board.
They allow smoking, yes, right. Because, in fact, they come across a packet of 100 packs of cigarettes in the stores at some stage.
Oh, God's sake. No, they don't actually pass them out. They actually stop them because they're having a bit of trouble with the oxygen. But otherwise, you can smoke to your heart's content.
Yeah.
And they're only checking into controlling station once an hour.
Yeah. And so anything could happen within that hour. That's why they can't find them initially. Yeah, that's right.
This sort of reminded me a bit of the basic idea behind the Martian. You know, it's sort of like it's a problem-solving
story. Very much that sort of thing.
And if you take it from that perspective, as you say, it's all right. But by God, reading it from this distance, it's a bit difficult.
Yeah, it's very creaky.
The interesting thing about this book was that it was originally published in the UK in 1961. Yeah. And it was overlooked for the 62 Hugos, don't know why, and then somehow ends up in the 63 Hugo ballot.
Okay.
Maybe it was a situation where it hadn't been distributed very well in the US. Maybe it came out right at the very end of 1961 and they stretched things a bit. You know, it might have been a Christmas book that came out in December, as opposed to these days, Christmas books coming out in, what, August?
Yeah.
And so they might well have just decided to stretch it a bit to add it in, I don't know, but it sat it there. Look, I thought this was sort of okay, but, you know, Clark's got good ideas, but boy, he's not a stylist by any stretch of the imagination.
No, no.
I got this one at 3.4. I didn't...
I probably rated it very slightly higher just for the suspense sort of element. And also, I said the concept of this sea of dust, I think, is pretty clever. So
yeah.
I rate it a bit higher, but not, it wouldn't quite get to a 4 for me either, don't think.
No, so, I don't think
it'd
be there.
So there we are.
Anyway, so that brings us down to the winner, David, which this year is The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we discussed this pretty heavily in the podcast in episode 30. So we won't go into this much in much more detail at all, other than to say that... it appears in the Guardian 1,000 books you should read before you die, or one of those things, one of those big lists. And I think it's a major piece. I think it's a major piece of science fiction that I think, if you're going to say to people, look, if there's say 150, 200 books that you should read in the genre, this is probably one of them. I can understand that people have got to the point where they feel that it just doesn't end very well. And that the way that he wrote it with the I Ching throwing his sticks or his die to get the next plot point, you know, I can understand that basically people might say, well, you never really know where it's going. I just love the way it flowed, basically. And if you think about just about everybody in the book, they're always trying to be something else. You know, like the Japanese consulate guy, he's really keen on... Americana, and he's trying to get all of the Americana that he can, including the gun that he uses to kill somebody.
Mm.
And then all of the major characters are attempting to be more than they actually first appear. I think it's an excellent alternate history, especially when you consider some of the other ones we discussed in that particular episode. I was glad to see that it won. It certainly is the best of the group that are here, and
yeah,
I was really taken by this book. I gave this 4.7, so I gave this really a high mark. This is easily a 5 out of 5 star for me, I think, and it's one of the high points. There's probably half a dozen really good Phil Dick novels, and this is one of them.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it certainly was a deserving winner of this category, but. Surprisingly enough, I would have listed Silver as second in this category, which is pretty interesting considering how terrible I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, well, anyways, didn't read it, so maybe I should try and hunt it down at some point.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, just as an aside, before we go on to the short fiction, I just thought I'd give you a list of some of the other possible books, novel nominees that might have made it in this particular year.
Sure.
Ballard's The Drowned World.
Okay.
Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Yeah, is that a collection of short stories made into a novel, a fix-up sort
of thing? Yeah, it might be a fix-up. Maybe that's it. Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yeah, now that should have been nominated,
sure. Yeah, but I don't know whether that would have got really wide distribution.
Yeah, probably not. In a British book.
It would not have been pushed as a science fiction novel either. It would have been a straight literary novel, and
yes.
I don't think people would have gone anywhere near it. But you read it now, ooh-wee.
Yeah, certainly you'd think it, if it had been distributed well, and I don't know, it's certainly a worthy nominee, yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely worthy of being on the ballot. Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time.
Interesting.
A lot of people have
juvenile.
Read that one. Naomi Mitchinson's Memoirs of a Space Woman.
I haven't read that.
Yeah, but it's got a very high reputation in the field. So, look, there's some interesting books there that didn't make the ballot. This will become more and more prevalent as we get further into the 1960s, where a number of books are basically just don't get anywhere near it, the ballot, which is... And some of them turned out to be real classics in the field. But I think Man of the High Castle was a pretty damn good choice for that year.
Yeah, sure.
And I'd be quite happy with the result they had there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So short fiction, David, you're going to look at the first one of this for us.
Yes. Well, this is a very interesting story. This story is called Mirror. I presume that's how you pronounce it. It's only a 4-page story. I say it's interesting that they're trying to balance this up with some of the much longer works in this category. And it's very odd. How can we explain it? It purports to be a case study of a psychiatric case study of this woman who's gone totally crazy. And her name's Shirley Spencer, and she runs a farm, and she gets visited by someone she went to school with called Mira Kyrenos, who's obviously Greek with a name like that, and indeed is Greek. And strange things end up happening, bad things end up happening. Her husband, Tom, apparently has an affair with this woman, or perhaps not, and eventually gets trampled by some horses on the property. And dies.
Or perhaps not. I can't work anything
perhaps,
out of this
book. Well, it's one of those book, one of those stories which you have really have to figure out what's going on, and it's odd. And her daughter Dory dies after eating mushrooms, poisonous mushrooms. And so this woman goes completely crazy because all these tragedies have happened to her. So it's clear that there's some desire on the part of the writer to make this about Greek mythology. But if you look up the story of Mira in Greek mythology, she was the mother of Adonis, but she got that way because she had a strong sexual attraction to her father. And so she falls in love with her father, and she manages to trick him into having intercourse with her. I can't remember now how she does that. Then when her father discovers that this has occurred and who this person is he's had sex with, he draws his sword and chases after her. And she runs away from him across the entire breadth of Arabia and being chased by her father, seeking vengeance for this thing. And they take pity on her and transform her into a myrrh tree, you know, as in frankincense and myrrh, that sort of myrrh. And while she's in the form of a tree, she gives birth to Adonis. So that's the Greek legend, which seems to have no relation whatsoever to this story, even though it clearly wants to get you to believe that there's a connection with Greek mythology. The story is not at all the same, and it's odd. And in fact, I was trying to do some research on this, and I discovered while doing that Piers Anthony included this story, reprinted this story in a collection of his called One and Wonder Remembered Stories. So it's just a collection of stories he remembers reading. And he says, I think I might just read this whole thing because maybe it might make some sense. It doesn't make sense to me, but here you go. And Piers Anthony says, "For those who may find it confusing, here's the summary as I see it. Myrrha was furious about a slight on her character that she believed Shirley had made, and conspired for drastic revenge. She arranged the deaths of the woman's dog and Shirley's daughter. She either seduced the husband and saved the seaman to artificially impregnate the mare, which is one of the horses owned by this woman, or caused Tom to think that he was having sex with Myrrha, while it was actually the... Yeah, I won't go any further. It's just his explanation seems even more confusing than the original story.
Really,
so
weird.
I don't know what to make of this. The fact that it was nominated for a Hugo, it makes me think I must be missing something. I don't know what it is that I'm missing, but yeah. I didn't get it. What about you? What did you think of it?
No, I thought that if I knew more about Greek mythology, I might be able to figure it out. Went looking it up, and I had exactly the same discoveries as you. Found out about the Greek mythology of Myrrha, myth of Myrrha, and it has no connection to this at all.
So doesn't seem to have at all.
I'm lost. I'm lost.
Yeah, I don't know. We're both lost, I think, yeah.
I don't know why it ended up on the ballot, but look, interestingly enough, it's actually in the same issue of fantasy and science fiction as another story, which you'll get to later on this particular ballot. So that's the Theodore Sturgeon that you'll talk about later. Maybe that's why it got picked up. Don't know. Anyway. I want to talk about a novella that's on the ballot called Where is the Bird of Fire by Thomas Burnett Swan. This was first published in the Science Fantasy magazine number 52 of April 1962. And it's a fantastical retelling of the Romulus and Remus story of the founding of the city of Rome, with the main point of view character of this particular story being Sylvan. So here we go, Sylvan. This is from your earlier book. Yeah. Now, Sylvan is a faun. He's half-human, half-goat mythological creature. So this novella follows the original story of Romulus and Remus fairly well, with the addition of Sylva becoming a close friend of Remus's, helping him conquer the city of Alba Longa, which is the one they live near, and which Romulus and Remus conquer. They reinstate the king, and then decide that they're going to build another city just up the hill a little bit. Sylvan also helps Remus get into contact with a dryad, a local dryad who helps him conquer the city. Now, Remus is killed by his brother Romulus. Again, that's exactly what happened. The new city has begun. And Romulus names it after his brother, and he calls it Rome. Now, this story was later expanded into the novel The Lady of the Bees in 1976. The reason why it's called Lady of the Bees is that the dryad is a friend of a whole lot of bees in that particular area, and she's able to harness the power of the bees to help Romulus and Remus invade and conquer the city. So that's why called that. That was in 1976, so that was like 14 or 15 years later. This story is very different from the rest of the ones that are there on this particular ballot. Most of the rest of them are, this is much more mythological. I suppose Myrrha is, a bit more along this particular line. But it just shows that the genre is starting to move a little bit. We're not keeping everything into this hard science fiction stuff. We're actually
No.
moving things out just a little bit further all the time. Swan is a rather forgotten writer in the field. He died pretty young, 40 at the age of 48 in 1976. But he wrote about 15 novels and published two short story collections. I don't know if he had anything else on the Hugo ballot. We'll find that out later on. But he's remembered by people who write in the fantasy field, but not remembered by really terribly many others. He just basically faded away. This is a very well-written story. I got into it and I started it off and I thought, oh no, I'm not going to like this very much. Actually, this is not bad. And then it just sort of flowed along and it just sort of ended. And you think, yeah, this is perfect length. This is really quite good. I rated this one fairly highly. I thought it was quite a good story.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't bad, and it seems, as you say, to follow the legendary story of Romulus and Remus pretty closely, but just with this added fantasy element, which yeah, I thought was pretty well done. It's not quite my sort of thing, but I thought it was pretty good. All right, so what does that bring us up to? This brings us up to the Sturgeon story, doesn't it? Now this is interesting in the sense that it was published as part of a special Theodore Sturgeon issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine, and so the whole issue is about Sturgeon with some of the stories like the one we've been talking about, Mirror. So When You Care, When You Love is the name of this story that was nominated, and again, it's one of those stories which is a bit hard to summarize, but it's basically about, we start off with this young woman whose name again is Silver, believe it or not. We've had several Silvers in the course of this particular set of nominees. And I should have actually mentioned that, while I was at it, that David Garnett's book, Lady into Fox, the female character in that is called Sylvia. So there's a lot of Silvers and Sylvias in this set of nominees. Anyway, Silver is the name of this young woman, and she's very rich. She's inherited a huge global corporation. We discover this as the story goes on, but as the story opens, she's really just in bed with her husband, and she's lying there admiring him, thinking how wonderful he is. And anyway, he gets out of bed, and suddenly he's hit with this agony, this terrible pain, and he's just squirming on the floor. And so Silver runs out and gets hold of someone who is her assistant, and they call for a doctor, and the doctor comes, and then they eventually get a specialist involved. And it turns out the specialist says, finally discovers that this young man, whose name is Guy Gibbon, has a form of cancer called choriocarcinoma. Now, this is a real thing. I looked it up on Wikipedia. It's a very unpleasant sort of form of cancer, and it can be classified as a germ cell tumor. It's either a cancer of the placenta in women, or in men it can be something which arises in the testes. Anyway, the point about it is that this young man is suffering this terrible disease and is going to die within 6 weeks. Now she, as we discover, as I said before, is filthy rich. She runs this huge corporation, and so she's determined that she's going to do everything she possibly can to save her husband's life. Now, the thing about this disease is that it essentially seeds the body with little, what would you say, reproductive objects, which are almost like little embryos. Seeds it throughout them throughout the body. Not quite, but that's what they almost like what they are. And she eventually determines that she's going to find a way to take these little things and turn them into a human being. And anyway, so we also get quite a lot of backstory of how she met this young man, and where it was, and all this story, and how the romance grew. So it's quite a long story. And there's also some interesting, nice stuff about this young woman and her assistant, whose name is Keo, Mr. Keo, and how he really has a sort of affection for her. He had to look after her when she was quite young, and so she's sort of grown up with him as her parental substitute, if you like. And there's a lot of quite interesting relationship material there. So that's all very interesting. And then, the thrust of the story is about this attempt using all these huge resources that she's able to bring, financial resources she's able to bring, to do this research and try to recreate her husband, essentially to clone her husband is what it comes down to. And then we get to the point where, yes, she looks like she may be able to clone her husband from these cells, but then he won't be her husband. He'll just be a blank clone or a child that's growing up, as any child grows up and developing their own personality. So she has this whole scheme to raise this child, a bit like the Truman Show film, where to raise him with all these people pretending to be these different roles in order to raise him identically to what her husband grew, how her husband grew up. And she, in the meantime, puts herself into deep sleep in order to be there when he finally reaches an age. So it kind of ends a bit strangely with a kind of an author's note to the reader, where he's trying to sort of suggest to the reader, you might be actually think you're a real person, but you may actually be someone being raised by this in this sort of situation. So it's kind of interesting. What did you think of it, Perry?
Yeah, look, I did think it was interesting. He just stops dead, though. Just
It does. It
stops.
very much stops dead, yeah.
But it's interesting that there's a note from the editor of the Fantasy and Science Fiction, who was Ed Furman, I think, was the well, Everin Davidson, sorry, Edward Everin Davidson was the major editor of this particular issue, and he states, "We are proud to publish this newest story by Theodore Sturgeon. It will form, though complete in itself, part of a book." And he has promised us the privilege of publishing the other parts as they are written.
And
He
did that
never wrote
happen?
them.
Ah, well, that explains it. That explains something.
I did a fair bit of tunning around to try and work out, well, okay, well, this sort of enough is enough of a story to lead you along. And I'm
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
yeah, I wouldn't mind
It's
reading.
very well written. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
Sturgeon was a damn good
He
writer.
was a damn good writer. But there's a whole lot of stuff that's come through the beginning of this particular novelette. I think it's probably novelette length, maybe novelette, where you think, well, this is obviously lead-in material for something that's going to go on beyond the end of the novelette, which you never get to see. It's quite peculiar from that instance, but all the research I did, I couldn't find anything that was there. And I actually read a piece saying that he just never got around to writing the rest of it. The other film that you mentioned, The Truman Show, the other film or book that this reminded me of was The Boys from Brazil by Ira Levine, where an ex-Nazi goes to live in Brazil. Name of the book. He goes to live in Brazil and he's taken some either some sperm or embryos that he has got or cells that he's got from Adolf Hitler and attempts to clone them and then tries to bring them up by introducing the major events into their lives that happened with Hitler, like the death of a parent, death of a close friend, this sort of stuff. And that's the type of thing that he was aiming to do here, where the Ira Levine thing, I think, was probably mid-70s, sometime before it was when it was written. So there's a lot of good things going on in this particular story, but it just stops dead, unfortunately, really.
It
And
does.
it really does read like the first part of something that could have been longer and much better. So, a bit
Yeah,
unfortunate,
indeed.
really. Moving on, we get to The Unholy Grail by Fritz Leiber. This is Fritz Leiber, published in Fantastic October 1962, another novelette. This is part of the author's Farfadet and the Grey Mouser series of stories. This recounts an early adventure of Mouse, as he was known at that time, and is the only solo Grey Mouser story in the series. So Farfadet isn't in this. This is all about the Mouser before he meets up with Farfadet. Mouser is the thief, or he's the thief of the two. Farfadet is the swordsman, where they get together and basically go off on adventures. It fits into a very much a strong sword and sorcery tradition, and Leiber basically pretty much helped to invent it with this particular series of stories. Now, in this one, the mouse is an apprentice of an exiled wizard at a land where magic is forbidden. He returns from a long quest to find his master dead, his house destroyed, and he's arrested by the Duke, who wants to basically clean it all up. Now, he casts a spell on the Duke and escapes only to be recaptured. He then utilises the blackest of black magic to get it to escape, kills the Duke and escapes with the Duke's daughter, as you do. And that's really the whole gist of it. It's a minor story in the series, useful for background if you're interested in the Farfadet and the Grey Mouse stories.
That's about it.
Okay, but that's really about it.
I would agree with that. It wasn't bad. It was a reasonable read, but it wasn't particularly exciting. It's not my kind of thing anyway.
It's just a slight adventure story and doesn't really raise any major questions. It's there to help you fill in the background of the rest of the series more than anything else, I think.
Yeah, indeed. All right, so we come to the winner of the short fiction category for that year, which was The Dragon Masters by Jack Vance. Now, I talked about this a little bit in my interview with Rob Durand when we were both congratulating each other on how much we enjoyed the work of Jack Vance. But I didn't go into any great detail there, so I'll try and cover it reasonably well this time. So it's all based on a planet called Aelith, and it seems that humanity has spread into the galaxy. And there was kind of a, if you think of it as the Empire, was a thing called the Old Rule, and that was the confederation of humanity spreading through the stars. But in years past, this seems to have fallen away, and these people are stranded on this planet. There's a couple of groups of people here. So the remnants of humanity are surviving on this planet called Aelith. But they're periodically attacked once every few generations by these aliens who are either called the Basics or Greffs, because they're in a sort of star cluster, and the star of the Greffs sort of comes closer and moves further away in the course of its orbit within this cluster. Now, when the Greffs star comes close, they tend to invade the planet Aelith, and they often take away a whole lot of captives. So this is, as the story opens, this has happened a few generations previously. It was the last time this happened. And what's happened is that the humans there were able to capture a number of these aliens, and since then they've been breeding them and turning them into different versions of the basic form of this particular alien. And indeed, they turn these aliens into, these aliens are kind of lizard-like, and they turn them into this variety of fighting creatures. So we have then they give them all these different names, and so we have the Termagant, the long-horned murderer and its cousin, the striding murderer, the blue horror, the fiend, low to the ground, immensely strong, tail tipped with a steel barbel, the ponderous jugger, skull cap polished and white as an egg. Obviously, that was a quote. And so they use these dragons to attack other humans. And there's a rivalry going on between one place which is ruled by someone called Joaz Banbeck, and he's the master of Banbeck Vale, and his rival, who is Irvis Karkolo, who is the master of Happy Valley. 10 miles is the distance between these two places, and so they kind of have battles against each other, trying to conquer territory and so on, using these fighting creatures based on the lizards. Now, so when the story opens, it's been several generations since the Greffs came. The star that the Greffs come from has come closer and closer, and indeed it's time for a new attack. And indeed that's what happens. The Greffs arrive, and the humans desperately fighting against these aliens. Now there's a third party involved, which is a group of humans who apparently were here on the planet before the other humans arrived, called the sacerdotes. And these are like hermit-like people, and they live naked in caverns, and they're sort of like priests or hermits, And they're very much focused on philosophy and, you know, sort of navel gazing and trying to determine the right way to live. And but they still have a pretty high level of technology, more than the rest of the humans on the planet. And they produce metal and glass for trade. And so one of the strategies that Joe Zbanbic puts into place is to, when the Grefs arrive again, is to try to get the sacerdotes to help him to fight off the aliens. But they don't want to be part of it. They're all, you know, they're above this sort of thing. So he manages to organize it so that when the Grefs are attacking the humans, their artillery that they're bombarding the humans gets closer and closer to the caves where the sacerdotes live. And finally to the point where they break down the wall of the, this cavern, and the sacerdotes are forced to defend themselves against this attack, and in doing so disable the spacecraft that the aliens have come on, and eventually the humans manage to get inside and conquer the aliens. So it's a nicely written story. Jack Vance has got this, I don't know, he has a lovely way of dealing with names and words and concepts, and it's I enjoyed it. And it's the first Jack Vance story I ever read, and it really sucked me into reading his work in the future. And in the version that I read, as I mentioned in the previous interview with Rob Durand, it's beautifully illustrated by Jack Gorn, these illustrations of these dragons, these evolved creatures. Now, the other thing I've omitted to mention is that the aliens themselves also have bred the men that they captured, the people that they captured, into being these fighting creatures. So we have this mirror image, if you like, of the aliens having shaped humans into the forms that are useful for them, and the humans having shaped the aliens into forms that are useful to them. And it's just really, really clever concept, I thought. So I liked it a lot. Still like it a lot.
I can certainly understand that. I think it's one of the classics in the field. I can't believe that I had neglected it up until now. Certainly the best of the ones that are on this on this particular ballot.
Yeah.
Vance is an excellent writer. He really just basically, his style is the style of his own.
Yeah.
But it's just easy to read. And he seems to be very knowledgeable in terms of warfare and history. And
well, some great clothing. Battle scenes, isn't
it? Oh, yeah.
It really is
quite good. There's a number of echoes of things down the line later on that you could basically almost push back to this. I mean, there's a touch of the Star Trek Borg in the aliens that come from the other planet down to enslave the humans. You know, there's this idea that we're here now and you're just going to have to you're just going to have to surrender. Well, we don't want to.
What?
Sorry? Yeah, No. You don't understand. No, it's now time for you to surrender. No, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
What? I don't understand. You know, there's just one track. They've only got one track. But I've also got echoes of High Crusade by Paul Anderson in this particular book.
Yes, this is much better, though.
Yeah, yes, I would hardly agree with that, but there's just, you know, there's connections here.
Certainly that business of humans, maybe John Campbell would have liked it, you know, the humans overcoming aliens with more superior technology.
Yep. This wasn't published in Analog or Astounding. It was published
in
Galaxy magazine. So Galaxy was picking things up, some quite good work up at that time. So overall, I really do think this was the best of the lot. I think they made the perfect choice in this particular case.
Yeah.
A couple of stories that may have ended up on the ballot. The major one, especially with your notes about Mira or Myra, in terms of why the hell was that there, a major one, which I think was also published in Galaxy magazine, so it wasn't off in some wilderness somewhere, was The Ballad of Lost Camille by Cordwainer Smith.
Indeed. That wasn't nominated. This.
How that wasn't nominated is beyond me. I really don't get it.
Yeah.
And we've got a couple of other things, R.A. Lafferty, 7 Day Terror, Brunner, John Brunner's The Fullness of Time, and Le Guin's first ever published story, April in Paris, which is quite a beautiful little time travel story. It's a lovely little story, better than Mira, let me tell you.
It wouldn't be hard.
So there's a number of others. So it's just strange where some of them won, and you just don't know exactly what it is, why they actually the one thing. So
No, it's a mystery.
other Hugos that were handed out that year, David, dramatic
Yep.
presentation, no
Yes.
award. The nominees were the Twilight Zone TV series, which I think had won the previous year. Last year at Marion Band.
Oh, I remember that film. I saw that.
Deeply, deeply weird film. The
Yes,
Day
yes.
the Earth Caught Fire and Burn Witch Burn. So they didn't, none of, nothing won there. Professional Magazine went to FNSF, which was edited by Robert P. Mills and Avram Davidson. So Davidson came in at the end, I think.
Yeah.
So beat out Analog, Fantastic Galaxy, and Science Fantasy. Best Professional Artist was Roy Krenkel.
Don't know him much,
Don't
no.
know him at all. And Amateur Magazine was Zero by Pat Lupoff and Richard A. Lupoff. And there were two special awards given out to P. Schuller Miller for book reviews and Analog, and Isaac Asimov for science articles in FNSF. I think Asimov had been screaming the fact that he hadn't got a Hugo up until then, so they decided they better give him one to shut him up. Though it's not actually a Hugo, it's a special award given out by the Worldcon Committee, which
Doesn't really count, does it?
doesn't really count. Yeah, so oh, there's a note here also on the Science Fiction Award database, which is an excellent website if you want to get all the information about this stuff, saying that the 1963 convention was the first to restrict nomination to members of the current convention, or the prior year's convention, with final voting open only to members of the current convention. And that's the scheme that's currently in place. So that's where that started. So things are starting to move. But anyway, we're still only with two fiction awards. We've ended up with four major fiction awards and a few others these days. So things move from there.
Indeed. All
Anyway,
right,
good
well,
year.
we,
I
yeah,
think the
good year,
two
interesting year.
winners. I think the two winners are classics in the field.
They are.
Certainly worth everybody's time.
Indeed. Okay, well, we've been talking for a while. I think we might sort of wind up there.
Next episode, we're probably going to go back to reading something a little bit other than science fiction all the time. So we'll see what we come up with, David. Still working
Indeed.
on that, and a lot of things that I have to read that I have yet to get to for some
Yes,
time.
indeed. I have this very long list of things I have to read.
Oh,
So
yeah.
we'll get through them. We will
Yeah,
get through them.
okay.
All right.
So
So
until next
we'll
time,
see you in a
David.
fortnight.
See you
Yeah, in
later.
a fortnight's time. See you then. See, bye, Perry.